This is the full moon night of June, and all the samanas have reaffirmed their commitment to the sila and following the tradition. And it's also my last night here at Abhayagiri, and tomorrow Ajahn Pasno told me we leave at 8 o'clock in the morning. So it's been very pleasant. Good to see that this monastery is prospering and doing so well through the efforts of Ajahn Pasno, Ajahn Amro, and all the monks and lay people to make this something that is of use, of benefit to both oneself and to all sentient beings. And so this Buddhist meditation is very interesting to see it being sought after and appreciated and encouraged in countries like this. Previously, I remember when I lived here in California about 40 years ago, I thought I was the only one interested. So I was a bit lonely. I was in a graduate school and I talked about Buddhism, and that they all gave me this kind of look of disdain, like I was some kind of cop-out, settling for some kind of superstition. So I thought, well, to survive here, I just have to shut up and not tell anyone. So I was what they call a closet Buddhist. But now it's very encouraging to see how wide the interest is. And here in California, of course, there's Buddhism in all its various forms and varieties, from traditional forms from Southeast Asia to different Mahayana schools, Tibetan and Chinese, Japanese, and all kinds of other modern interpretations, American Buddhism, and or California Buddhism, I suppose. In Britain, it's called British Buddhism. But to me, these the schools or the conventions or the different traditions are, you know, not to be clung to, because what we're really interested in is the Buddha Dhamma, awakening to the truth of the way it is, rather than aligning ourselves with some kind of convention and then being bound, limited, and blinded by our own attachments, even though we might be attached to something very good. But attachment is attachment, and if attachment or clinging done out of ignorance then obscures any possibility of enlightenment or seeing the truth. So even being attached to even the very best conditions is still an obstruction. So getting to the very essence of Buddhism, the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha never taught Buddhism. No, he wasn't actually a Buddhist. He taught the Dhamma. So, no, in the traditional sense, in the historical sense, then Buddha is a word which means like a human individual awakened, seeing things as they are. So that's why you can have images of the Buddha. You can have human forms, like Buddha Rupas are the human form, in the sitting in the aware, awake. Buddha Rupas are usually conveying that image. It's an icon. It's a kind of traditional form, artistic form, but its message is awakenedness, the human individual awake and aware. So it's not meant to be some kind of idol that you project all kinds of powers and other things into, but It's an image that helps us to remember that in ourselves, that Buddha, that awakened state, that is the real refuge that we can only find within ourselves rather than in somebody else or in some external way. Now, language itself is limited. Remember that thinking is a function of the mind. And thinking is a dualistic function. If you have good, you have to have bad, and right and wrong, black and white, and so forth. So thinking itself is linear, it's dualistic. Now this word dualism means, if you're dividing the universe, means one into several or many or myriad. That's what thinking does. It's a divisive function of the mind. It's critical function. And as long as one is bound to the thinking process, then of course you'll always be in that state of feeling incomplete, unfulfilled, something wrong, something lacking. If you can't get beyond your own thinking process, and you're just bound to ideas, opinions, views, thoughts, no matter how refined, good, or superlative they might be, it's still its very function is division and dualism. We use our thinking process to criticize. We compare. We notice how one thing is bigger or smaller, better or worse. And so as long as we get are identified and bound into the thinking process, it will only be caught on that level of maybe we can refine our thinking process and develop more altruistic, more sublime patterns of thinking, but it's still not liberating. So it's very important to contemplate, what thinking, what language is, how words affect consciousness. Now consciousness itself isn't dualistic. So when we are trapped in our own thinking process, then our conscious experience tends to seem dualistic. So there's a sense of I'm Ajahn Sumedho, you're separate from me. Now when I through visual consciousness, and using my eyes to, I can see that I'm sitting here and you're sitting over there. It's obviously, a division of some sort. And so the senses themselves are divisive functions, because they pick up that which is an object. So the eyes can notice what is in their field of vision through consciousness, or sound through the ears, smell through the nose, taste through the tongue, feeling through the body. And the mind itself, caught in the thoughts and the memories, the conditions of the mind, the sanya sankharas that we create in the present always create this division, this dualism, this separateness. So how can we get outside that? How can we free ourselves from that ailment? Because that's why the world is the way it is, why human society is so fraught, so confused, why we have wars and strife and acrimony, why even in relationships we have difficulty relating one person to another, because of our own thoughts, our own views, the seeming separateness which we cling to and hold to. And then, of course, even with the most loving relationship, the most ideal relationship with somebody else, still there's something missing in it. that there's something that's lacking. Because no one else can fulfill us. Nothing else outside us can bring us enlightenment or real peace. So when we try to seek peace, enlightenment, and fulfillment from external sources, we're inevitably going to be terribly disappointed. Because that's an impossibility. Now, this is not to be believed. This is a reflection. Just saying this to encourage you to reflect on, on your own mental states, on your conscious experiences, not from the sense of personal identity, but from through this mindfulness, this way of observing, not through attitudes that we've already formed, but through trusting in a natural state of intuitive awareness. So I've been using this term intuitive awareness for sati sampajanya. These are the Pali terms, and satipanya. So sati then is the mindfulness, awareness. Sampajanya is like to apprehend, to be able to apperceive, it's on the wide scale of including, where perception tends to be confined to an object. Apperception brings the whole, the moment and all that is in this present moment into consciousness as one, rather than dividing it up into 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. Now, our cultural conditioning is very much one that tends to raise the intellectual abilities, reason and logic, as the kind of ultimate human attainments. So modern science and our intellectual conditioning is very much one of developing our thinking process to become very discriminative, critical, to acquire a lot of information about all kinds of things, all kinds of subjects, to analyze ourselves, compare ourselves with ideals or with others or role models or whatever, and to always see ourselves in terms of the critical mind. I mean, most people I know in the United States and in Britain tend to be very self-critical. Very few people I've met really like themselves very much and see their own goodness. Most people are very much aware of their failings, their weaknesses, faults. And this is because very much we've been programmed or conditioned to see ourselves in this way. Now, the United States always seemed to me to be a very idealistic society. Being born here and brought up, one is brought up with this kind of very inspired sense of freedom, democracy, justice, fairness, the ideals of a nation in which, are very inspiring. They lift the mind up. They're kind of beautiful images of human thought. And because of this, we're not usually, unless we're brought up, say, in some kind of mystical tradition, we don't tend to develop anything outside that in any intentional way. So the tendency is to always compare the realities of our life with the ideals that we have. We can always see how things should be, how the government should be, how mother should be, father should be, how children should be, how the society should be. And then the realities, how oneself should be, and then realities of the moment, are never like that. We're much aware of the unfairness, the inadequacies, the stupidity, the things that are wrong. So this creates a kind of confusion in the mind, because we end up complaining and blaming. Always looking for someone to blame for these flaws or these faults. So either we're blaming somebody external or blaming ourselves. Now with awareness, instead of doing this, instead of blaming and trying to analyze or figure things out or come from ideals of how things should be, the Buddha pointed to the way things are. So Dhamma, this word Dhamma means the way it is. And the way it is, he gave some kind of hints. He said all conditions are impermanent. But that's not, that doesn't say, you know, that's not, what does that really mean, you know? What good is it to know that everything is impermanent? And so the purpose of this teaching, all conditions are impermanent, is to look at this moment, begin to observe, witness to the changingness that you're experiencing here and now. Physically, emotionally, mentally, in whatever way you're experiencing this moment, instead of looking at it in terms of the critical faculty, the good, bad, right, wrong, we're looking at it, observing, training ourselves to notice, to observe the changingness of whatever you're experiencing, like pain or pleasure, emotional sadness or happiness, thoughts, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch. So taking this hint that the Buddha gave, all conditions are impermanent, if we explore that and really observe change rather than criticizing the state or the conditions that you're experiencing in the present, or just being lost if they're pleasurable, just, you know, getting kind of overwhelmed and lost into pleasure-seeking, putting yourself in that position of awakened attention, intuitive awareness, then you begin to develop insight. So insight knowledge isn't an intellectual experience. So we can't just, you know, tell you what an insight should be. But we can point to that possibility by saying simple things like, be mindful, wake up, pay attention. Now in my own experience, you know, I've been one who likes thinking and likes to analyze and criticize, having a mind that inclines towards that, being quite having a skeptical nature. I found that, you know, after so much education, I just, I was getting weary of the amount of negativity I'd endlessly create in my life, and the kind of worried anxiety and self-aversion that seemed to be the dominant experiences in consciousness. So, and wondering why, what's wrong, you know, is it some kind of personal flaw? Am I missing something? Is it some kind of genetic inheritance? Or was I missing something when I was born? Maybe my mother had eaten something she shouldn't have. Then I began to realize that it was endemic, that everyone is like this. You know, and that was comforting in one way, that I wasn't the only one. But Another way, one began to really try to understand what being human is about. What's the point? What's the purpose? What's this life all about anyway? Because on one level, on the analytical level, I could not figure out any point to human existence, any purpose for it. I was brought up as a Christian, and of course, my mother would say, you were born to love God and to be good and to go to heaven and live forever with the Lord. But that didn't appeal to me, actually. I couldn't really see the point of it. Because the character is one of skepticism. It didn't make sense, and it didn't even, the idea of living in this individual state for eternity with God just didn't make sense. And so, began to feel a kind of frustration with religion in general until I came across Buddhism. My first experience with Buddhism was reading D.T. Suzuki, who was becoming revived in the mid-50s here in the here in California. So something about Zen Buddhism attracted me, the idea of, because it did offer alternatives, other ways of looking at things. The Christian conditioning that I received was very dualistic. It was an absolutizing right and wrong, good and bad. Good was an absolute, and therefore bad obviously had that, even though the Christians would say it's not, yet when good is absolute, bad seems also absolute. and same with right and wrong. So one is, I felt suffocated, kind of bound to a kind of rigidity of thinking that intuitively seemed unbearable to me. How to get out of that rigidity of this dualistic way of thinking. And of course Zen Buddhism challenges that very much so in its use of paradoxes and koans and ways to stop just the thinking process. To be able to stop just being caught following habits of thought in order to observe, witness, pay attention to the process of thinking and the absence of thought. Now, when I started meditation, I couldn't see how to stop thinking, even though I knew that I had the insight that I had to stop thinking, but I didn't know how to do that. And I can't remember, I kept saying, just stop thinking. And so, how do you just stop thinking? Well, just stop. Well, how do you just stop? Stop! And then for a moment there might be but then I'd start again. So trying to use willpower to suppress thought wasn't working. You know, just having an anti-thinking view was another thought, another viewpoint of attachment. So obviously one had to transcend the thinking process, get beyond it rather than just suppress it because of you think you should not think. So thinking that I shouldn't think, one is just caught in the cycle of thinking, and there's no way out of it. So how to stop thinking and to know non-thinking in the present moment. So at this point, I was still Samanera, and this is before I met Ajahn Chah. I was in a monastery in Nongkai for about 11 months, And I figured it out. I figured out how to stop thinking. And this was, I'd found these books, these Zen books on Zen, and the using of the Huato. And this was strange because we were at the city of 10,000 Buddhas the other day, and I was given the two-volume biography of Master Shu Yun. And it was this very Master Shu Yun whose teaching I used to stop thinking process when I was a samanera, because I had some books on called Chan and Zen series by Charles Luke. And the first volume, they had a 10-day sesshin given by Master Shu Yun in 1959 in Shanghai. And so I just followed Master Shu Yun's instructions, and day by day, you know, I did it, you know, since it was a 10-day sesshin, I took one day at a time. And the Huato is its Chinese word, is to really get to the, before you think, to recognize the gaps between thoughts. So in my own interpretation of this teaching, I had the insight into letting go. So I used the words let go, and just kept, used it like a mantra. So I just say let go, and until the kind of rabid, obsessive thinking would kind of calm down. And then I'd examine these two words, let and go. So I'd deliberately be thinking these two words, but observing myself thinking. But the point was to be aware of the space around the words. It wasn't just a kind of conditioning process with another idea of letting go, but using the English words let and go for observing before I think let, there's a space, and deliberately think let, and then there's another space, and consciously observing space or the absence of words, absence of a thought. The gaps between the words. Before I think, let go, and after go, there's no thought. Now this was using consciousness. I mean, there's consciousness still present. There's awareness. And there's awareness of thought and no thought. So this was an experiment that I found very useful, because then I began to really develop that sense of non-thinking by deliberately thinking, but not thinking in order to get caught in the thinking process, but to observe it. Because just as I said before, you're trying to stop thinking because you've got an idea you should do so, doesn't work. But instead of trying to just attack or suppress thought, I would deliberately think, but not in order to attach to thought, but to see it as an object, put it in the context of a mental object. Now this is where, say, like vipassana, insight knowledge arises, where we begin to have that confidence in reflective awareness, observing the way it is, knowing the way it is, from this position that we find ourselves. So right now, I'm sitting here in this seat, the physical body, and consciousness is operating. And from this point, then if I don't create myself through attachment to views and opinions, to memories and ideas, but just trust in the awareness of this moment, then I can see the thinking a process as it arises and ceases. Thinking is something that arises and ceases in consciousness. And when there's no thought, there's still consciousness. And when there's thought, there's consciousness. So consciousness has a continuity. You know, it's not, sometimes in Theravada Buddhism we think that we're only conscious through, it's very like, it's impermanent. Consciousness is impermanent. So we tend to try to conceive that maybe, enlightenment is being unconscious, but that doesn't make sense. But to know consciousness, being that what the consciousness is like this, with attachment and without attachment. So say consciousness with attachment, I become a person. I start thinking about myself, I start creating myself, I have memories. I identify with the body, with the age of the body, with the gender of the body, with the convention of being a Buddhist monk, being Ajahn Sumedho, being American, being somebody from Seattle, I'm also British now. So I can start creating myself as British. That's not so easy to do. It's hard to free yourself from your early identities. So, but observing this, you know, like the Sakkayaditti, or this fetter, they're called Sakkayaditti, or personality view. Now this is very interesting, to know the difference between pure awareness and when we empower our egos with the subjective, in the subjective position. Say, for example, the awareness, then there's no sumedho. There is awareness, there's consciousness. It's sensitive, it's complete, it's full. And then to become Ajahn Sumedho, then I have to think, start operating in the condition of my mind. I'm Ajahn Sumedho. And then if I'm not aware at that time, I tend to become what I'm thinking. So this is what I call empowering our egos to be our subjects. Now when I out of heedlessness and not understanding the truth of the way it is, then I tend to operate from the ego. Life is always interpreted according to me and mine. I'm Ajahn Sumedho, I'm this person, I feel good, I feel bad, I feel happy, sad, right, wrong, secure, insecure, I'm worried, anxious. All the old identities, memories, habits around that illusion of being this Sakkayaditti then take over. And what happens when I get lost in the Sakkayaditti or the ego is I feel very insecure, confused, unfulfilled, full of skepticism and doubt. I can feel angry about things, wrongs that have been done to me 40 years ago or whatever. I just get caught in my emotional habits and then my life is, you know, I get super sensitive. People say the wrong thing, I get very upset. People praise me, I get kind of very happy and overwhelmed with my self-importance. But then the next moment they start criticizing me, I can fall into another hell realm. Emotionally, I'm very unstable as a person. So, on this level, by giving my ego the power of the present moment, I am a hopeless victim of conditioning. So how to get out of that trap is to awaken to it. Is not to run away or to, you know, try to control everything so nothing too unpleasant contacts me. And get into a kind of controlling obsession of wanting to try to protect myself from any kind of unpleasantness is another kind of fear that wherever you go, there's always that possibility of something bad, something unpleasant happening to me as a person. But if I let go of that, begin to observe the sakyaditti, the ego, not critically, not to say, you know, to analyze why I feel this like this or have these emotions or these reactions to life, but to observe from this position of Buddha, of the Buddha, of pure subjectivity, then the ego, the sakyaditti, is seen as Dhamma. It arises and ceases. Sape sankara anicca. All conditions are impermanent. So this is a way you can actually begin to break out of that trap of the ego, of that identity, and start trusting in the pure subjectivity, which is putto, or awakened consciousness within this individual form. Now, the wonder of it is that just in being human being allows us this opportunity. And so that's why in Buddhist societies, Buddhist countries, the human birth is considered the most fortunate. Now in Thailand, a lot of Thai people rather be reborn as Devadas, which certainly sounds better than being human, actually. I mean, Devada would be very nice also, because, you know, that not have a physical body would be very nice. When you have a kind of ethereal body, one that didn't have to go to the toilet or anything like that, didn't get pain and wasn't so coarse and grow old, get bad knees and arthritis. Have a ethereal body like a Devada sounds really nice. Be beautiful and refined. But this also is impermanent. Devadas also are mortal creatures. So what the Buddha was pointing to was, you know, the opportunity we have as human beings for enlightenment, for complete and full enlightenment. Now when you think about yourself as a person, you probably, every one of you would think that you can't really do that, because the condition of the mind tends to be critical, and we can see so many obstructive qualities, selfishness and greed and anger and hatred and jealousy and fear, obsessive habits of worry and so forth, neurotic. So we can see ourselves very much always as so far removed from complete and perfect enlightenment that it's hard to imagine that ever happening in this lifetime. So because of that, we tend to say, maybe if I practice, you know, keep the sila and so forth, I might be reborn in a little higher state in the next life, hopefully. But this is all thinking again. This all comes from the self-view. This is all sakyaditti. Whatever you conceive yourself to be is sakyaditti. You know, so whatever concept it might be, no matter how truthful you're trying to be about yourself, the self-view is a fetter. And this is why it's so important to to be able to know this pattern. We're not trying to stop the thinking process, attack it, never think another thought again. Because thinking is a great gift that we can use. You know, how to use the thinking process rather than just be victims of our thoughts. So in Theravada Buddhism, in the Pali Canon, of course, these kind of teachings are to be, you know, like the Four Noble Truths and the Paticca Samuppada, the Satipatthana. These scriptural teachings are wisdom teachings. They're not wisdom in themselves, and you can memorize them all and still not be wise at all. But it's they're pointing at wisdom. They're teachings that help us to look, to observe, to witness, to awaken in a way that we might not realize if we didn't have such teachings. How to use the Pali teachings for awakened awareness rather than just becoming Pali scholars or Theravadan Buddhists is to awaken to see the way it is or the Dhamma. Now, the Four Noble Truths is probably the most profound teaching of any. I mean, I rate this as the kind of the plus ultra, the top of human creation, because it is something that I've used for many, many years now, for nearly 40 years, as a reflection on experience. And it's taking these Four Noble Truths, and not, you know, it didn't take me long to memorize the Four Noble Truths, because it's like the handful of leaves. It's not very much. Intellectually, I could get carried away into much more than that. But I didn't want that. I didn't want to know everything about everything or all about Buddhism. But to see Dhamma, to have that clear insight, direct knowing, which didn't depend on words, ideas, concepts, teachings, scriptural teachings, but using the scriptural teachings for a suggestion for looking at this present moment like this. So with the First Noble Truth, the truth of dukkha or suffering, this is beginning to observe, to put myself in that position of the putto, observing the feeling of worry, confusion, doubt, anger, greed, envy, jealousy, fear, insecurity, whatever, boredom, aversion, whatever it might be in the present moment. So, now because these are conditions of the mind, say all these emotional states, then the awareness allows us to see them as mental objects. When we don't do this, then we tend to identify ourselves with our emotional experiences. So the sakyaditti, or the ego, the personality, is very much, you know, an identity with your memories. They have retentive memories, with our emotional habits, with the conditioning of the mind. So to awaken to that means to cultivate this path of awareness. Now it's not any, you know, the awareness is ultimate simplicity. And it's to be recognized. In the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, in the Third Noble Truth, this is where we actually have that insight into mindfulness as the way, as the path. Because mindfulness allows thoughts to arise and cease, observes and knows emotions of elation, depression, happy, sad, loneliness, boredom, lust, greed, anger, aversion, jealousy, all the rest. Because each one of you know when you feel anger, you know there's anger. Or, in a way, maybe we don't want to know. I mean, I remember one time somebody telling me, when I was a layperson, they said, "You're angry." And I said, "No, I'm not. I'm not angry." I mean, I mean, I obviously was, because I wasn't aware that I was angry. I was caught in the anger. Or the lust, the sexual desire, one gets caught into it. So you can't see it, you just, or you deny it, or you try to suppress it. We develop what are called defense mechanisms, or ways of avoiding our emotions, not willing to look, observe, to receive, to know them and study them. But certain emotions, you know, we like, and certain ones we don't like. Being a monk, you have to deal with a lot of emotions you don't like at all. And it's not all the kind of options. Sometimes you don't, it's hard to get away from some of these emotions, where in lay life, you know, I felt a little bit of insecurity, I'd go and make a sandwich, or eat something, watch television, or do something or other, distract them. Like the more kind of exciting emotions, like anger and greed, but in so much of monastic life, what you have to deal with are like sloth torpor, dullness, and restlessness and doubt, because monastic life is not exciting, isn't kind of, you know, thrilling, romantic kind of experience. It tends to be monotonous and boring, where we feel dull, we feel bored with it, we feel restless. We'd like to do something, you know, have some fun, have a little, you know, go on a spree. And full of doubt, you know, thinking, what am I doing this for? You know, what's the point of this monastic life? I remember in Thailand, you know, going through periods of just utter boredom with, especially in the hot season. Ajahn Pasno wouldn't understand this. I don't think life can get so utterly dreary and boring as Thailand, as I would get in the hot season there. You just feel totally enervated, you know, energy, trying to get off the floor is a major effort. Then you think, well, if I went back to the States, you know, weather isn't so hot, and I could, you know, do something else. But I did have a lot of faith in the practice, and also started using these feelings, you know, started observing. And it's very important, like with the nivaranas, the especially the last three, the five nivaranas are like greed and aversion. Then tinamita utacha kukucha vichikicha is the way you experience dullness and slothfulness, sleepiness, and restlessness, mental and physical restlessness, and doubt. Now, doubt's always the result of thinking. If you stop thinking, you stop doubting. So see how to learn from these conditions. So, you know, at least lust is quite exciting, and it kind of makes you feel alive. anger is an indignation, righteous indignation. Feeling as a Buddhist monk, you know, righteously indignant. That brings me into, oh, I'm really feel alive at that moment. You know, feeling righteous, and we've got to not let those people get away with it. But but to sustain righteous indignation and lust is not part of monastic practice. So a lot of monastic practice tends we tend to get through those very quickly and get stuck in sloth and sleepiness, dullness, mental confusion, doubt. So then reflective awareness, then these are, to be able to have the insight and the appreciation of awareness as a continuous reality rather than just momentary. So in developing awareness, you begin to see like the gaps between the words. Before, I think, let and after, go and after. Begin to notice and consciously recognize non-thinking. Now this has a profound effect through insight, because usually we don't notice non-thinking and consciousness when we're not thinking or conceiving ourselves in some way. So our experience of life is very much bound to our ability to perceive things in a certain way, our habits. We're victims of our habits. We're limited to our memories, our habits, our opinions and views. And so the way out of that is through the awareness. And that awareness, to really cultivate awareness. Now in my own life, over the years as a monk, cultivating this awareness in the midst of a quite active life, because I was asked to be start the Wat Banana Chant when I only had 8 bosses, and so this was. This was the last thing I wanted to do, was especially I didn't feel that capable at 8 vasas to take on such a duty. But this happened, and Ajahn Chah wanted me to do it. And ever since 8 vasas, and this will be my 39th vasa this year, I've been in a very active mode of being head monk wherever I go. I was propelled to this height at a very young age, monastically speaking. So, and then going to England, when I had only 10 bosses. So how to develop mindfulness while you're caught in all these duties, training, establishing monasteries, and an active life. Where before, it was very much, seeking solitude, physical solitude, and peacefulness, wanting to move out of any kind of duty or responsibility toward living alone, towards developing tranquil mental states, which I like very much. Still do, in fact. But this was what life was bringing me. And so how to develop awareness in the life, in an active life. So this was the challenge, how to do this. And so this is, I did have enough insight by that time to have confidence in this path, in awareness. I knew I understood awareness. And I knew how to develop awareness. I was quite confident in that. I had no confidence in my ability to be abbot of a monastery or be a teacher or anything. When I started thinking of myself as being head monk, being a teacher, and I could only feel a sense of despair. Because when I start seeing myself with these perceptions, the old personality habits start taking over. The self-criticism, the feeling of, I'm not ready, I don't want this. I don't want to be in a position where I'm going to be blamed a lot for everything. When you take on being head monk, you're a sitting duck. You're sitting there and everybody can say anything that goes wrong is your fault. So, and this is exactly the position I've always never wanted to be in. Because I'm a coward. But I didn't have any doubt about the path, you know, developing awareness. And so Ajahn Chah, this encouraged me, you know, that this was the point, you know, this was the living example that I could relate, you know, see in Ajahn Chah. Was he lived quite an active life. He was always with some people, always busy with things, and yet always mindful. He never seemed to be overwhelmed or lost or that, and things, all kinds of things would happen to him. He'd get blamed for all kinds of things too. Now we think of Ajahn Chah as a kind of super monk. He's a apotheosis up in the sky and with all the great stars. But actually, when you're living with him, and you know, he was blamed for all kinds of things. His monks would get angry and leave him, and sometimes they'd say, "Oh, you know, Ajahn Chah doesn't know what he's talking about." But even in the midst of blame, he seemed to be able to stay aware, you know, he wasn't dependent on what the world said about him, either positively or negatively. So obviously, Lumpa Cha had that kind of insight into the awareness, the value of awareness as the path. And he seemed to use that in his life, in his life in teaching us, and in his position as head monk of a monastery. And during the years I was with him, he was establishing branch monasteries all over the place. When I first went there, there were only three. And now I think there are 300. So because of that, you know, the emphasis Lungpa Cha made on this awareness and the fact that he wanted me to take on this responsibility, I had enough trust in Ajahn Chah to follow what his lead. So in my life, say in the West also, that's been always the priority, that awareness. I had to all recognize that, because when you're dealing with establishing monasteries and being a teacher of Dhamma and all that, it's so easy to be intimidated. You know, the kind of way people will elevate you, put you up on a pedestal, will look to you and praise you or condemn you. So there's so many, you know, possibilities when you're in the public eye for practice of awareness. And so always keeping centered within here, you know, aware of what actually I'm feeling. So when I first went to London, I didn't realize what I was getting into. The English Sangha Trust at that time. I was very impressed with the chairman, George Sharp, and he warned me, but I didn't quite see what he was talking about till I arrived there. And there were the English Sangha Trust was split in two warring factions. And so I'd attend these meetings where these two factions would start yelling and abusing each other. And here I was in the middle of this, everybody looking at me. And then I couldn't help, you know, on one level to favor one side over the other. On a personal level, you know, I felt more inclined to favor one side and tend to be less sympathetic with the other. And so on the level of personality, I'd get very confused, you know. What, they expect me to solve these problems, to resolve these conflicts. They're all looking at me when all this was going on. And I just felt, I don't want to be here. I want to go back to Thailand. But Numpa Tha insisted that I couldn't go back for 5 years. His last words were, don't come back to Thailand for 5 years. Which was very wise of him, actually, because I honor Lungpa Cha's suggestions. So even though much of the time I felt like, you know, I'd love to have gone back, I didn't. I stayed with it. I began to develop this awareness in the midst of these acrimonious meetings. So when I was in Nong Khai, the Samanera, I began to notice that when I was in this really aware and wasn't attached to anything, that I began to notice this, what I call sound of silence, a kind of cosmic buzz or kind of resonating background sound or vibration. So because I had developed that a little bit in Thailand, one day I was walking down Haverstock Hill in London, where we lived in London for the first 2 years, one afternoon, and I began to, the sound of silence like attacked me right on the street. I remember walking down, I remember exact spot on Haverstock Hill, where suddenly this resonating sound, I remembered it, I'd forgotten it. And so then I knew that if I developed this in England, then I would be able to sustain my awareness through the crises of the people around me. So the next English Sangha Trust meeting I went to, I tuned into this, and I was able to be fully present there, but not caught emotionally in all the reactions and the power of the emotions that were going on at the time. It was in London itself, in a big city like that, that I actually began to have more sense of emptiness and deathlessness than I ever had in Thailand. So, I mean, it's very strange, because you think, you know, the last place you'd want to develop meditation would be London. But actually, those 2 years in London were very important years for me, and because it confirmed my insights that I'd had in Thailand, to be able to develop this awareness in the rush and noise and busyness of a London Buddhist vihara. And in the process of trying to solve the conflicts within a trust, and be able to eventually find something, and, you know, because the whole intention was to find a place in the countryside None of us wanted to live in London on a permanent basis, but the English Sangha Trust had this house that we could use, so we stayed there for 2 years and eventually acquired Chithurst Forest Monastery. So then Chithurst Forest Monastery was a derelict. Chithurst House was an old Victorian house, about 22 rooms, big stone house, and the inside was derelict. One room had fallen completely into the cellar below, and the place was riddled with dry rot. So we had this big house. We had to renovate this house. So the first 5 years at Chithurst was working, renovating this old house while developing a community life. And so then, of course, people began to take an interest and want to become monks, and the women wanted to make some stronger commitment to become nuns and so forth. So the Sangha developed at Chithurst, and we had to expand it to Amaravati. Through those years in the UK, which have been 28 years now, the practice of this awareness has and been no way obstructed. And yet I've been through all kinds of ups and downs, successes and failures, all kinds of pleasant and painful emotional experiences. But keeping the priority of awareness is to me the reality of non-suffering. So it doesn't mean wouldn't feel anything. It's not like I just pack up and don't notice. No matter what happens, I go into a kind of state of bliss where nothing touches me. In fact, mindfulness makes you more sensitive. You're completely sensitive, completely open. But instead of, because you're not afraid of that anymore. You're not afraid or frightened by sensitivity, by consciousness, by limitation, by the human experience. So you can always learn from it and relate to it. Like with praise, with the accolades that one acquires, this is a pleasant side of it all. Not to get lost, let the ego take over and claim these positive qualities in any way, but to certainly be aware of it. The pleasure, the happiness of being appreciated and praised and so forth. The other side, being blamed and criticized, this was most difficult. And yet, that is, I found that through the very difficult patches of monastic life where where everything seems to be falling apart around you, monks disrobing, people being disillusioned, and I'm being blamed for it all. It's through the only way to deal with it is awareness. Because on the ego level, it was very painful. I could really, really, if I allowed the ego to take over, I'd get very distressed, very upset. But I certainly felt it. I felt the pain of being condemned and blamed. But it wasn't suffering. I wasn't creating suffering onto that. So the suffering of the First Noble Truth is not that, it's not, it's about the suffering we create out of ignorance. It's not trying to escape the world and kind of live in a blissful state of absolutely on no feeling whatsoever, but it's really opening to our humanity and sensitivity and learning to understand and learn from that by not creating suffering on what we're experiencing. So if somebody blames, starts condemning me personally, I feel it. I can listen, I can understand, I can feel it in my body. Whether I create suffering around that is up to me, isn't it? If I'm aware, if I trust in my, if there's awareness, then I'm not going to create any problem around it. I know better than to feel sorry for myself or to hate the person that's blaming me or to defend myself or whatever. Because having explored, having investigated Dhamma, you see, you know, the way of non-suffering is very clear, a very precise path. It's not fuzzy, it's not idealized, it's not something that depends on situations being pleasant or peaceful or quiet. It's available always here and now. And it is a path that you can develop and cultivate in daily life, in whatever experiences or conditions you're having in the present, pleasant or painful or neutral. So I've spoken long enough. You're probably feeling it in your body. And that I could keep you for another hour so you could explore, not to create any suffering onto the pain in your knees. But I won't. So I'll stop here. I wish to thank everybody, Ajahn Pasano, Ajahn Amaro, and all the monks that have made my stay here a very pleasant experience, and the lay people. It's feel an incredibly beautiful spot you're in. A very lovely area to live in, and the monks, you shouldn't suffer here. You're as close to paradise as you can get.